Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. I want to thank you for joining us on the show. For those of you who want to catch up on our previous episodes, remember to check out our website at voanews.com. We are also on all social media platforms, on Twitter, on Facebook, on WhatsApp, and on Instagram. So be sure to connect with us on there too. Now, as we've been doing in the last couple of months, the first part of our show today is a continuation of our series, exploring the impact of the COVID-19 global pandemic. Over 5 months since the WHO declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic, the United States has registered more than 5 million people now. The country has recorded more than 160,000 deaths, nearly a quarter of the world's total. Global coronavirus cases pushed past 20 million this week, with the United States, Brazil, and India accounting for more than half of all known infections. Around the world, millions of students have been out of school, and as the International Labor Organization reports, school closures due to the COVID-19 crisis has disrupted the education or employment of 70% of young people aged between 18 and 29, and has led to severe job losses and increased poverty. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A survey of 12,000 young people in 112 countries in April and May describes the devastating and disproportionate impact the pandemic is having on their education, training, and job prospects. The International Labor Organization finds youth in low-income countries who cannot easily access online learning are particularly hard hit, while 65% of young people in the richer countries were taught via video lecture. The ILO survey finds only 18% in the poorer countries could study online. The director of the ILO Employment Policy Department, Sun Jun Lee, says similar disparities exist in the realm of unemployment, where 1 in 6 youth in poor countries has had to stop work since the onset of the pandemic.
It's not just about the job losses. Even for those who actually remain employed after the onset of the pandemic, the working hours fell by nearly a quarter. And 2 out of 5 young people reported a reduction in their incomes.
The report finds the impact of COVID-19 lockdowns, job losses, and fears for their future are affecting the mental well-being of young people, with 50% reporting an increase in anxiety or depression. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. A large proportion of people in Africa works in the informal sector. Lee tells VOA that during past periods of crises, Africans who may have lost their jobs in the organized labor market could usually count on the informal sector as a last resort to make ends meet.
But now, this option is not readily available at the moment because all the informal, commercial, or sales, whatever activities are heavily affected by the lockdown or related restrictive measures. So they cannot use these informal activities as basis for their survival strategy.
The report warns young people of this so-called lockdown generation are likely to suffer prolonged problems from the impact of the pandemic. The ILO is calling for urgent, large-scale, and targeted policy responses to protect a whole generation of young people whose employment prospects risk being permanently scarred by the crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Now, since the outbreak of the coronavirus in December of 2019 and subsequently the WHO declaring it a global pandemic in March of this year, analysts say that there's been an explosion of information across all media platforms, especially on social media, on WhatsApp. If you are on WhatsApp, you know what I'm talking about. In regards to what the origin and impact and effects of coronavirus are. So we hit the streets to find out what some of you are thinking about some of the misconceptions and misinformation or myth and misconceptions about coronavirus. Let's hear what you had to say.
Personally, I don't have a lot of misconception because I believe in what the society, what the society believe in. But of course, there are very many people who do believe that COVID-19 is just a political propaganda that people are trying to play to make money, to hand money out of WHO. So many people don't believe that the numbers that are being reported are really true.
Because I can finish a month without wearing a mask, without washing my hands, but I haven't got COVID-19. In Uganda, there is no COVID-19, but in other countries, there is COVID-19. But here in Uganda, there is no, brother. Let me tell you this. In Uganda, there is no. If we have a small number, for those people who came from abroad to Uganda.
Given the fate of our health system, the fact that our health system is itself sick, if we registered as many cases as, for example, Brazil or the United States or just our neighbors, just Kenya, I think it would be very hard, extremely hard for Uganda to cope up with this COVID-19.
Those were some of your voices, the voices of our listeners. We want to thank all of you who contributed to that. And we want to welcome those who are just joining us. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. And like I said in our last show, these past couple of months have been very tough on everyone, regardless of where you live or what you do for a living. The coronavirus has killed thousands of people worldwide, and millions of others have contracted the deadly virus and continue to deal with its impact. Whether it's the millions who have lost their jobs, students who are not able to attend classes, others who are unable to travel to visit loved ones for fear of contracting the disease, etc. The pandemic has upended our lives in so many ways. But even in these difficult times, there are those moments that deserve special recognition and a little celebration. And one of those moments, at least here on the show, was in July of this year, 2020, when we celebrated the 86th birthday of legendary author, social activist, poet, and the first Black African to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. I'm talking about Mr. Wole Soyinka. A little over a decade ago, in 2010, we hosted the Nobel laureate on this show. He spoke on a range of topics, his philosophy on life, on religion, on politics. We even talked a little bit about football, or what others call soccer. At the time we spoke, it was during the World Cup in 2010 that was held in South Africa, the first time the World Cup was held in South Africa. So we did have a little conversation about that. But I wanted to play you a snippet of that conversation. And in this case, he addresses some of the political issues in Nigeria in 2010 in a little bit of a flashback.
Recently, we spoke to former President Obasanjo about some of the issues, political issues in Nigeria. And one of the contentious issues, of course, was the power vacuum that existed when the late President Yar'Adua was hospitalized, and there was some sort of a power vacuum. And it seemed to me that this is something that constitutionally they didn't forecast to happen. How do you characterize some of the political events in Nigeria in the past couple of months?
Let me begin by commenting on former President Obasanjo is alleged to have said in recent times. I mean, in fact, and this, of course, is related to the kind of power, the uncertain and rather untidy power tussles, if you can use that expression, a bit on the strong side, but still, it was a period of great uncertainty.
Right.
And I consider Obasanjo to have laid the seeds for those active anomalies which we've been experiencing in recent times. The entire democratic venture was completely bastardized and degraded under Obasanjo. The culture of rigged elections became accentuated under his 8-year rule. And in fact, the whole issue of a power vacuum was, of course, for me, a complete artificial one, which is accentuated again by those whom he had placed in position, very often in a most undemocratic way. So let me just say that I would rather make my own comments without reference to what he happened to say, because I hold him responsible for much of the agony that Nigeria has been undergoing.
Well, the political problems that have been in Nigeria for the past couple of years, you mean?
Yes, that's quite correct.
Okay.
And the kind of government which was run by his political party, PDP, these really are largely responsible for the intolerable political condition which we experience in Nigeria. And it's the culture of illegality that he established. And I mean that very seriously. The culture of illegality, the practice of illegality in government. This is what was carried over by that macabre episode that we've just undergone, where a president who was obviously terminally ill, and I'm not just saying this because he's dead now. I mean, this is something which we said and wrote at the time, that the former president was no longer capable of ruling the country. The people around him knew this. They continued to lie and lie to the nation, create all kinds of fantasy scenarios that never did take place, of the president, former late president, doing this and doing that. It's all a lie. And it's ironic. And it's ironic that somebody like Obasanjo should be one of those who then found himself compelled to demand that the truth be told to the people. But I'm sorry, the culture of lying to people, of deceitful governance, began and reached its apogee under his regime. That really was the irony of his making statements, which happened to tally with what most people were thinking and saying and demanding at the time.
Now, the other issue that has been making news lately relates to one person, former President Babangida, who many analysts also characterized in the same terms that you have used to characterize Obasanjo, as a person who was responsible for some of the problems in Nigeria. What do you make of the news that he's planning to run for presidency?
I find it incredible, quite frankly. I think Babangida has misread the Nigerian people, and probably this is a tragic misreading. If your head is hot, the water could cool on.
That was Nobel laureate Wallace Soyinka in 2010. As we celebrate the life of this great African author, a living legend by all accounts, I called on another acclaimed author, Mr. Oke Ndibe. Mr. Ndibe is the author of a number of novels, including Arrows of Rain, Foreign Gods, Inc., and his 2016 memoir, Never Look an American in the Eye. Ndibe's latest book, The Man Lives, A Conversation with Wallace Soyinka on Life, Literature, and Politics, was born out of the life and works of Mr. Wallace Soyinka. It was also born out of his personal relationship with him as a mentor of sorts. Mr. Ndibe joins me via Skype from Connecticut for a part two of our conversation.
In fact, I was the one who named an ex-Nigerian dictator. I named him Maradona.
Oh.
1986.
Which one was that?
Babangida. Yeah, what happened was he was a military dictator at the time, and he had a very strange statecraft. Babangida's attitude to problems was to appoint a committee to examine an issue, and then they will give him a report. He will appoint another committee to look at the results of that committee. Then he will appoint a third committee to look at the results of the second committee's work. And so it was a way of, if you like, circumnavigation, you know, it's kind of circuitous mode of governance.
Yeah.
Using to take decisions.
If you do write an autobiography of Babangida, you call it the committee man.
Precisely, committee man.
Autobiography.
So what I said was he was a dribbler, like the Argentinian football player.
Ooh, I said
why the football player would dribble in order to score. I said that Babangida stayed in the midfield and just dribbled and dribbled and dribbled, and there was no purpose to his.
Was he just a bad footballer? He was deliberate. He knew he was intentional in his dribbling circles.
He was a politician, and he did say so. So he was perhaps the most adept Nigerian military politician. So
he understood how the game is played.
Precisely. So he was dribbling people. So it was, he kept the nation in thrall to this whole idea that he was modernizing us and that he'd come to transform the space. And so he set up a committee, as I said, that would be given a very important charge, but he refused to commit to a cause of action. So it was all about this secularity of movement and so on, interminable movement in the midfield.
I would imagine that you were a student at the time. Or you were done with high school.
No.
You were done with college.
I left school in 1983.
Okay.
So this was 1986 when he was
3 years out of college.
Yes, 3 years out of college. So I actually began to write for newspapers and magazines in Nigeria. Last year in high school, my piece was carried by a major state newspaper in my home state. And then when I was in college studying business at a polytechnic, I began to write for the biggest newspapers in Nigeria. And then I reviewed books for Africa Magazine in London and wrote the occasional political piece. So it was...
it was within your domain to be able to understand this man,
precisely.
What he was,
precisely.
And political games.
And the thing is that the name, the Maradona became his name. So
it caught on.
Yes. If you say to any Nigerian, which your leader, you know, so in fact.
You started the name Maradona for.
Precisely. I called it Maradona and it caught on and people began to call him Maradona, you know.
Did he ever know that people call him Maradona?
No, you know, because he himself sort of felt flattered. But when I wrote the piece I wrote where I named him Maradona was so critical that a lot of people felt he would arrest me.
It went viral for 1986.
Precisely. It went viral, you know, the manual way of going viral. Yes. Yes.
So he unless he was very insulated, you know, he found out what he was. But you say he'd actually knew, but he thought he was a compliment.
Well, what happened was the piece, I don't know if he read the piece, but the piece was very unsparing. But then everybody started calling him Maradona. So other newspaper columnists will then name him Maradona. And so he took it on. If you like.
He embraced it.
He actually described himself in an interview as an evil genius, you know. So, yeah, he called himself an evil genius. And one of the enlightening things that he said was that he said he was struck that Nigeria had not collapsed.
Was that his intention?
You see, that's the thing, because he knew that he and his cohorts did so much.
They're surprised that this state is still resilient.
Gotten the resources of the country, but also really destroying the country democratically. You know, so one of the things he did, by the way, was that he had this, again, interminable transition program. So he promised to return power to civilians, but he will start a process. And just before the elections, he will stop everything and say, oh, we need to start again. You know, there is some new changes that then he will reset. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, he will annul it. And then he held the elections, June 12th elections, 1993, which MKO Abiola won. And then he staged ultimate annulment, which led to his own demise, you know, because Nigerians simply refused to accept being played this time by
the after the death of Abiola.
Well, before, no, Abiola did not die yet.
Yes.
So once Babangida annulled the elections, so he elections were held. They were, by most accounts, the most peaceful and decisive and credible elections in Nigeria's history.
Mm.
But he decided that he was going to cancel the results.
Which was won by Chief Mashuda Biola.
Precisely.
The billionaire, very rich man, was very popular.
So the country, sections of the country, then began to resist this. And so what he did was, because he wanted to continue in office, but he knew that it was untenable. So what he did was he brought in Abacha, who was one of his
military
henchmen. And so he put Abacha in place with a businessman, Ernest Shoneko, was now, he put Ernest Shoneko as head of what he called a transitional government, with Abacha as sort of the transitional military guy, and within a few months...
Were they co-presidents or president-vice-president?
Ernest Shoneko was president. Abacha was supposed to be the military chief. That fired him and basically took over in a few months.
That was a very interesting time in Nigerian history, by the way. At least it happening in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Those, you know, few months that kind of shook Nigeria. I think Nigerians at some point decided, like, we've had enough.
Yes.
So let's go back to, Mr. Wole Soyinka. You did, you know, talk about, you know, I said we talked about soccer and, you know, not a big fan of soccer, but we know that soccer is kind of a religion on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
But also we did talk about religion, and he said something that was so profound for me that in a way shaped my understanding of religion. And I will play it for our listeners to,
mm-hmm.
to hear. But I had been trying to find something, meaning, you know, of the concept of religion and the role of religion in society. And you know, he I guess he was able to, like, capture it for me. And, you know, but did you talk about religion and his understanding of religion?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Soyinka is, I guess you can say he's an atheist, okay? Or he prefers to say that he's a humanist. But Soyinka is fascinated in his role as writer, especially, but also as a being in Yoruba
mythology,
cosmology and mythology and right. so. Especially has studied in his works parallels between the Yoruba cosmological scheme and the Greek one.
Mm.
And so he has an intellectual interest.
Curiosity.
Mm. In religion as a phenomenon. But he's also very, one of the things that concern him very much is the ways in which people kill in the name of religion, or people silence others in the name of religion, or people just debase others in the name of religion.
Mm.
But he's also very capacious in his attitude. Soyinka, as I said, he's not a believer, and yet he resists anybody who mocks people of faith. Mm. You know, he respects the right
absolutely
to believe as well as not to believe. The other thing he believes in, he sort of has an ecumenical spirit, if you like. And so one of the things he told me in my long interview was that as a student at Leeds, that he used to sneak into different religious traditions. So he would go into a Catholic church and, you know, listen to the liturgy. He'll go into a Protestant church. He'll go to a mosque. He'll go to a Jewish synagogue. He said he was just curious about these religious groups. And so, if you like, in his writing, there is this sense, in some of his writing, of this eclectic sense of the different faiths informing.
In his speech to the Nobel Committee in 1986, yes. A speech that he, I believe, dedicated to Nelson Mandela or the struggle mm-hmm. for the end of apartheid in South Africa, mm-hmm. he referenced something known as Idanre.
Idanre, yes.
Does that, what is yes. that?
Idanre is actually a kind of hill, you know, in Ondo State, you know. So it's a very scenic hill. I was just there last year. At least I drove past it because I went to a conference in honor of Soyinka, where my book was presented for the first time, my book on him. So Idanre is a system of hills that are really very enchanting, but have deemed to have some mystical resonances and so on. And Soyinka is very a student of mystery, if you like.
Mm. Yeah. That's very interesting. I'm very intrigued by that. Mm-hmm. And you know, when he won the Nobel, literature prize, this was
1986. Yes.
What does he think about the fact that he's the only person who has so far won that on the continent? Does he ever think about it?
Well, I asked him questions about that, you know, because that's interestingly, that's a very contested issue, if you like, in Nigeria and in Africa, right? Soyinka, in his book, I believe, which is the book, The Burden of Memory, in his, you know, book of essays, speaks about his fate almost, his confidence that the first African to win the Nobel Prize was Lepo Seda Senghor, the Senegalese leader and poet. So when Soyinka won the prize, there was near universal celebration in Nigeria. People were proud. But there were also pockets of politics, you know. One of the political arguments that were, one of the arguments advanced was that it should have gone to Chinua Achebe, for example. So there were people who believed that the prize should have gone to Chinua Achebe.
There were different camps. There were two camps, the Chinua Achebe camp and the Washington camp.
Precisely, which was fortunate then, and I think unfortunate now.
Right.
So I asked Soyinka this question, whether he was surprised that no African has won the prize, and and I asked him about Ngugi, for example.
Ngugi wa Thiong'o, a very much deserving writer. Every year we hope that he wins.
Precisely, Ngugi has been part of the conversation every year. There are speculations that Ngugi is one of the top candidates, and so on. And so he was not very willing to get into that conversation. What he told me is that he nominates candidates. And that some of the candidates he's nominated have won and some of them haven't.
And with that, we come to the end of our show today. I want to thank my guest, Okendibe. You can check out his work at okendibe.com. We still have another part left of our conversation in the coming week, so stay tuned for that. Let's catch up next time right here on Upfront. But until then, stay safe. And as Wallace Soyinka says, the man dies in all who keeps silent in the face of tyranny. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Good day, Africa.